told Rosa. Gotta break the record, man. Slowly, Rusa closed in. At last the two ships met, but a moment later they drifted apart. Rusa was mystified. He decided he hadn't come in fast enough to trigger the docking latches. He would have to back off and come in a little faster, and he knew that would cost him more fuel. There goes the record, he said mournfully. Soon his disappointment turned to concern, as the second attempt failed. Something was wrong with the docking mechanism. Over the next hour and a half, in consultation with Houston, Rusa made two more attempts without success. No one had to say what they all knew. If they couldn't link up with Antares, the mission was over. Shepard's crew wasn't about to give up. The culprit might be something as simple as a tiny piece of debris on the mechanism. If so, it should eventually disappear, but they couldn't afford to wait indefinitely. In a few hours, the Saturn's third stage was going to vent its extra fuel, and when that happened, they had better be at a safe distance. If Houston didn't come up with a fix, Shepard thought, they would have to take matters into their own hands, literally. After putting on helmets and gloves, they would depressurize the cabin, open the command module's top hatch, and bring the probe inside. There they might be able to fix it. After Rosa steered Kitty Hawk back to Antares, Shepard would reach through the tunnel and pull the two ships together by hand. When the ships met, he was sure the docking latches would engage automatically. His only worry, one shared by his crew, was that the managers in the back row of mission control would not let them risk it. And 5 days from now, there would be another link-up in lunar orbit when Shepard and Mitchell returned from the surface. Trouble then would force the men to make an emergency spacewalk to the command module. They'd trained for every conceivable emergency, including that one. But would Houston accept that possibility now, when it would be far less hazardous to abort the flight? Hey, Stu, this is Gino. It was Gene Cernan's voice from Mission Control. We've got one more idea down here. Cernan told Rusa he should fire Kitty Hawk's thrusters to hold the command module against the LM. As he did so, Shepard would flip the switch to retract the docking probe out of the way. If the two craft were lined up properly, Cernan said, the contact might just trigger the docking latches. 1 hour and 42 minutes after his first attempt, Rosa once more steered a course for Antares. About 6 feet out, Mitchell said. About 2 feet. Here we go, Rusa said. They felt the ships touch. Okay, Rusa said. Retract. Shepard hit the switch and waited. Nothing happened. Nothing? I don't know. Suddenly Shepard saw the indicators on the panel in front of him go from gray to a pattern of stripes. I got barber pole, he called. At that moment he heard the telltale ripple bang of 12 docking latches snapping shut. Shepard announced, we got a hard dock. An hour later, the joined Kitty Hawk and Antares were drifting away from the third stage on a course for the moon, and Shepard, Rosa, and Mitchell settled down to finish up what was becoming a long first day in space. It had been a close call. It would not be their last. Monday, February 1st, 1971, 7:37 a.m., Houston time, 16 hours, 35 minutes mission elapsed time. In the dark, floating in Kitty Hawk's left-hand seat, a tired Stu Rusa tried to settle in for the night. Like those who had come before him, Rusa found it difficult to adapt to sleeping in zero-G. He wished he could lay his head on a pillow. 45 minutes later, still awake, Rusa noticed a light coming from underneath the right-hand couch, where Ed Mitchell was in his sleeping bag. Rusa assumed Mitchell had turned on his flashlight because he'd gotten tangled in a strap. He could not have guessed the real reason Mitchell was awake, that he was conducting his own private experiment in extrasensory perception, unknown to anyone except a handful of people on Earth. Edgar Dean Mitchell grew up as a rancher's son amid the dust storms of the Texas Panhandle and eastern New Mexico. His father was a man of nature who had a great love for his animals. His mother was a fundamentalist Baptist. As a boy, sitting beside his parents in church on Sunday mornings, Mitchell was confronted by an inner conflict. The preachers in those small churches were the fire-breathing, Bible-waving kind, and the younger Mitchell found himself doubting the existence of the God they praised and the Satan they warned of. By the time he reached high school, he had concluded that the creation story was allegory. Not literally true, as the preachers insisted. Their stern admonitions against social and sexual transgressions, even dancing with girls, repelled him. As much as he respected his parents and the church he was raised in, as much as he sensed a great body of truth in its teachings, he could not follow that path. His strong interest in math and science only deepened his sense of irreconcilable conflict, for neither side seemed to acknowledge the other. From then on, Mitchell hungered for resolution, and he carried into adulthood a desire to understand the nature of the universe. It was still with him when he became an astronaut. When the press asked Mitchell why he wanted to go to the moon, he told them it was the logical extension of everything he'd been doing as a fighter pilot and then as a test pilot. He was also quick to mention his scientific curiosity, and in truth, the greatest lure was the chance to explore the unknown. When he arrived at NASA, the 19 had little hope of flying on Apollo, but Mitchell had his sights on a more distant goal, to captain the first manned expedition to Mars. By 1970, it was clear that NASA would have to abandon, for the time being, any plans of sending people to the Red Planet. But by then, Mitchell was already training for Apollo 14, and even as he looked forward to probing the secrets of Fra Mauro, he saw a chance to explore a frontier even more mysterious than the moon, the nature of consciousness. Mitchell was probably the only astronaut who missed the presence of psychologists in the space program. NASA had engineers to handle the technology of flying to the moon, and scientists to puzzle over its geologic riddles, but no one to unlock the inner experiences of the men who had been there. About 3 weeks before the flight, a chance conversation inspired Mitchell to take advantage of the fact that he would become one of the few human beings to leave the planet. As some of his colleagues knew, Mitchell had long been fascinated by the study of psychic phenomena, for which neither science nor religion offered a satisfying explanation. He'd become acquainted with a couple of surgeons in Florida who shared his interest. Together they wondered, was it possible to transmit thoughts across 100,000 miles of space? In the midst of the all-consuming preparation, Mitchell told them, line up some people and we'll do a little experiment on the flight. And so they did. Each night of the trip to and from the moon, Mitchell planned to perform the experiment, waiting until 45 minutes past the start of the sleep period, when he had privacy and quiet. He kept his plan a secret from NASA, knowing that the agency would be completely unreceptive to the idea. He said nothing about it to his crewmates. The test subjects had also agreed to keep quiet, and Mitchell wasn't worried about what would happen if someone found out. With all the canceled missions, he was already certain that Apollo 14 would be his only spaceflight. Now, floating in his sleeping bag, Mitchell pulled out a small clipboard bearing a table of random numbers. Each number designated one of the standard symbols used in ESP experiments. A circle, a square, a set of wavy lines, a cross, a star. Mitchell chose a number and then, with intense concentration, imagined the corresponding symbol for several seconds. He repeated the process several times, with different numbers, knowing that on Earth, four men were sitting in silence trying to see the pictures in their own minds. After several minutes of this, Mitchell put the paper away and closed his eyes. Had Roosa known of Mitchell's activities, he wouldn't have been too surprised. In Roosa's opinion, Kitty Hawk was carrying three people who, within the narrow military test pilot filter, were as different from one another as it was possible to be. On the circle of astronauts, they spanned a full 360 degrees. Deke Slayton always said he could put the three most divergent personalities in the astronaut office on the same crew, and they would do just fine. As far as Roosa was concerned, the Apollo 14 crew proved him right. Friday, February 5th, 1:33 a.m., Houston time. 4 days, 11 hours, 10 minutes, mission elapsed time. Ed Mitchell tapped on the instrument panel with a flashlight as Antares drifted through darkness over the near side of the moon. Only 90 minutes away from powered descent, the mission of Apollo 14 was once again in jeopardy. He and Shepard had been checking the lander's guidance software when engineers in mission control detected that the computer was receiving an errant signal from the abort button. They guessed that a tiny ball of solder was floating around within the switch and closing a contact, and sure enough, when Mitchell tapped on the panel, the signal disappeared. For the moment, it had no effect, but if it came up when Shepard and Mitchell lit the descent engine, the computer, not knowing any better, would read the mistaken signal and automatically abort the landing. Since Apollo 13, mission control had trained for every malfunction in the book, and there literally was a book with procedures for any conceivable emergency, but not this one. Once more, there was nothing to do but wait for mission control to come up with a solution. In Houston and in Cambridge at MIT, computer programmers began a feverish effort to work around the malfunction. They would have to tell the computer not to accept any signal from the switch at all, to lock out the erroneous command. But that would mean rewriting a portion of the LM computer software right away. At MIT, a young programmer named Don Iles went to work. He was done before Shepard and Mitchell went behind the moon for the last time before the scheduled powered descent. By the time Antares reemerged, the programmers had streamlined and improved the fix and relayed it to Houston. With only minutes to go before ignition, Mitchell keyed in the necessary changes, telling himself, "It's just like a simulation." A good trick to stay calm. He and Shepard had been through some horrible scenarios in the simulator. By comparison, this was almost a leisurely operation. But when the descent engine lit at 3:05 a.m., Shepard and Mitchell held their breath. The fix worked. As the engine rumbled silently on its long brake, Mitchell keyed in a few additional changes, and they kept going. Once again, the experts on Earth had saved the mission. 3:09 a.m. 4 minutes later, as Antares descended through 32,000 feet, everything still looked good. The next step was for the landing radar to lock onto the echoes of its own signals bouncing off the surface of the moon. But on the computer display, caution and warning lights glowed, signaling that the radar had still not locked on. "Come on, radar," Mitchell said quietly. "Let's have the lock on." Still no change. "Come on, radar." "Go at 5, Fred Hayes radioed. 6 minutes into the burn now. Velocity was good. Altitude estimates by both the primary and backup computers were in agreement, but still no radar. Shepard and Mitchell knew that if the radar didn't come in by 10,000 feet, the mission rules specified a mandatory abort. Now Hayes told them, "We'd like you to cycle the landing radar breaker." Shepard pulled the circuit breaker out and pushed it back in again. "Okay," he radioed. "It cycled." Antares was down to 22,000 feet now, and Mitchell could no longer hide his urgency. "Come on!" Suddenly, the caution lights went out, and the radar signals began to come in. Within seconds, the men could see that its data were good, and Houston confirmed that fact. Once more, with help from mission control, they had made a narrow escape. And when Antares cleared 8,000 feet and pitched over, Shepard and Mitchell were electrified. Cone Crater was dead ahead, right where it should be. "Fat as a goose," Shepard said, and proceeded to steer Antares to a smooth touchdown, closer to his target than any other landing in the Apollo program. When the dust had settled and they were on the moon to stay, Mitchell thought back to their close call, when Antares had been flying beautifully, and only the balky radar and the mission rules had stood in their way. He asked his commander, "What would you have done?" Shepard wasn't about to say what he was thinking, that he would probably have rewritten the mission rules on the spot. Radar or no radar, he would have continued as long as everything still looked good. To Mitchell, he said simply, "You'll never know." 8:54 a.m. It is impossible to look up at the full moon and not notice Mare Imbrium. the huge dark splotch that forms the man in the moon's right eye. Down where his right cheekbone would be, the lunar module Antares rested on a region of hills and craters called Fra Mauro. The roughness of the place surprised Shepard and Mitchell, who had expected to see something resembling the Mare plains visited by their predecessors. Instead, it bore the scars of eons of cosmic bombardment. Shepard was filled with the realization that time here was measured in billions of years, rather than the thousands of years spanned by human history. Nevertheless, just before 9 a.m., when Shepard stepped off Antares's foil-covered footpad, the words he spoke were not for the timeless moon, or even for the history books, but to mark the end of his own personal odyssey. It's been a long way, but we're here. Finding his balance, Shepard made his way to one side of Antares and cast his gaze to the east. There, beneath the solar glare, was the broad rise of Cone Crater. Tomorrow he and Mitchell would climb to its summit in search of geologic treasure. He told Houston the way would be clear. He could see that even from where he stood. Shepard realized that, finally, everything was going well. After all they had been through, he felt sure he would have his full-up mission. He took a moment to lean back so that he could look up into the black sky, and near the zenith his gaze found a small and lovely blue-and-white crescent. Suddenly he was overcome by the beauty of the earth, by the undeniable majesty of Fra Mauro, and by his own feeling of relief, standing on the gray dust of this promised land. Shepard cried. For several long moments, while the checklist went unnoticed, his tears flowed in spite of himself. 3. Solo. Saturday, February 6th, 12:26 a.m. Houston time. 5 days, 9 hours, 53 minutes mission elapsed time. Stu Roosa hadn't slept well, but when Kitty Hawk came around from the far side of the moon on his 14th revolution alone, he lied about it and told Capcom Ron Evans he'd gotten 6 hours of good sleep. In fact, he'd had a fraction of that, and none of it good, but he didn't want anyone on the ground to worry about him. And thanks to a steady flow of adrenaline, he felt well. But as he brought Kitty Hawk's systems back up for another day, Roosa took a deep breath. Yesterday had been long. Today would be even longer. His solo voyage was turning out to be a 41-hour fire drill. Roosa was pleased at how well-prepared he'd been for this whole business, so well that on the trip out, to his surprise, he did not experience awe or amazement at seeing the Earth shrink to the size of a marble. After hearing 5 Apollo crews talk about the dwindling Earth, there wasn't much impact when he saw it for himself. It wasn't until Apollo 14 was more than halfway to the moon that he sensed the immense distance. It came not by looking, but listening to the long moment of silence between his call to Houston and the response. As for the conversations themselves, well, the air-to-ground transcripts from this mission were going to be just plain dull. The talk was all technical, and that didn't surprise Roosa one bit, not with this crew. There were no weather reports from space, no light-hearted exchanges with mission control. It was 36 hours into the mission before they said anything about the view outside, but they weren't there to talk about the view. Roosa had thought he knew what to expect from the moon, too, but nothing had prepared him for what he saw just before lunar orbit insertion, when a thin but enormous crescent moon loomed beyond the windows. On the tape player, just by chance, was one of Roosa's favorite hymns, How Great Thou Art. He couldn't have asked for better background music. When I in awesome wonder consider all the works thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the mighty thunder, thy power throughout the universe displayed, then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art! How great thou art! Gazing down on the moon from 69 miles, Roosa wished he could take an orbit to do nothing but look at it. But his mission, the first intensive program of scientific observation in lunar orbit, was far too demanding for that. It was largely the mission Ken Mattingly had meant to carry out. Like him, Rusa had spent much of the past 19 months working with the geologists. Each of his assigned craters was a geologic world unto itself, with its own peculiar features, its own riddles. His solo book, crammed with photographic tasks, was as demanding as the one Mattingly had prepared for Apollo 13. On top of all this, he had the work of a command module pilot, landmark tracking, maintaining the systems, firing the SPS engine to adjust his orbit. It was a grueling workload, and time seemed to be slipping through his fingers, mostly because the single most important piece of gear for his geologic reconnaissance, an automatic, large-format camera called the HiCon, another holdover from Apollo 13, had conked out. The HiCon was a huge thing. The lens alone was as big as the 18-inch hatch window. It had a motorized film transport and exposure controls at its own timer. With it, Rusa had planned to take photographs that would show features less than 7 feet across. Just hours after he and Shepard and Mitchell arrived in lunar orbit, Rusa unpacked the HiCon and mounted it at the hatch window. It breezed through about 140 frames, then it began making a distressing clack-clack-clack-clack-clack until he turned it off. Since then, he'd spent much of his time troubleshooting. He unplugged and reconnected every cable again and again. He unmounted it and peered into the lens with a flashlight while it clacked away. Houston offered troubleshooting advice, but nothing seemed to help, and he'd already lost so much time that he was way behind schedule. Rusa was too busy to notice his isolation. Most of the time, the exceptions came after sunset. As Kitty Hawk drifted silently through the realm of Earthlight, the cabin cooled slightly, just a few degrees at first, but that was enough that the environmental control system could not remove all the moisture in the air. Then the spacecraft went out of radio contact and into total, unyielding darkness. He liked the solitude, but he couldn't deny a feeling of loneliness. His only company were the stars that filled the sky, except where the moon blotted out even these distant companions. While Rusa worked, the air turned clammy, and suddenly it seemed he could feel the darkness. He knew, in that moment, what it was to be utterly alone. After nearly a half hour of this, longer than most previous missions, because the landing site was well to the west and most of the near side was in sunlight, something remarkable happened. In a finger snap, the cabin was flooded with sunlight, and it was such a glorious feeling of renewal, even rebirth, that Rusa said to himself, "You know, we're really not creatures of darkness." Rusa realized where he was and felt great and small at the same time. It was the moon that made him feel big. He had made it all the way out here, and it was the sight of the earth. Now, for Rusa, an object of undeniable wonder and nostalgia that made him feel small. Only once, near the end of the first day, did Rusa have a brief respite from his flight plan. It happened after the last experiment of the day, which called for him to take pictures of the Earth-lit part of the moon using high-speed film. When the time came, on his 8th solo orbit, he pointed Kitty Hawk straight at the moon and turned out all the cabin lights. Mounted in his rendezvous window was the Hasselblad camera. All was silent except for the soft whine of the cabin fans, which he had long ago tuned out, and the steady click-click-click of a timer telling him when to snap pictures. Below, shadows of morning lengthened as Kitty Hawk drifted westward, making the ocean of storms jagged and forbidding. Every ridge, hollow, and pinhole was sharp. One large crater straddled the Terminator, half of its rim in brilliant sunlight and half lost in the night. Even as Kitty Hawk crossed into blackness, he kept firing off pictures. After a few moments, his eyes adapted to the darkness, and the moon reappeared, bathed in soft blue light. He photographed the Earth-lit ground for several minutes, and then the experiment was over, and his flight plan for the day was finished. No more experiments, just grab a bite to eat, take care of some housekeeping, and go to bed. But for now, Rusa let Kitty Hawk drift, its windows pointed at the moon, and allowed himself the luxury of just looking. Not a single light glowed within the command module. Rusa floated in total darkness, except for the window in front of his face, which framed a strange and eerie tableau of craters, plains, and ridges, rendered in soft tones of bluish gray. His eyes registered remarkable details. Now he began to see shadows cast by the earth as deep as space itself. As Kitty Hawk coasted westward, while the earth sank progressively lower in the moon's sky, the shadows lengthened, and the moonscape became a maze of strange patterns of blackness and blue-gray land. As Kitty Hawk approached the realm of total darkness, Rusa saw a jumble of shapes that played tricks on his vision. Like a child looking under the bed with a flashlight, he saw the dragons of his own imagination. It was a spooky, marvelous encounter with something unknown, in himself, as well as in the moon. Then Kitty Hawk was engulfed in total darkness. Rusa turned up the cabin lights and began his last chores before closing up the command module for the night. There were no moments like that on this second day alone. From the time he woke up and plunged into the troubleshooting on the Hycon once more, he was on the run. He realized he had put more into that solo book than he could possibly accomplish, and that he had nobody to blame but himself. Before the flight, he couldn't say no to the scientists who suggested another crater to photograph. He was here for them. His time in lunar orbit was so precious that he couldn't bear to see any of it wasted, but too much of it had gone to troubleshooting the Hycon. Around 5 a.m., Mission Control decided to abandon the camera altogether. That meant Rusa would have to step in and, using a Hasselblad with a 500-millimeter lens, take detailed photos of a place in the moon's central highlands called Descartes, which was under consideration as the landing site for Apollo 16. If Rusa did nothing else, he had to return to Earth with pictures of Descartes that would be good enough to plan a lunar landing. To keep the landing site in the field of view of the telephoto lens, Rusa would have to turn Kitty Hawk precisely as he sped past, firing off pictures at the same time. So much confidence had been placed in the Hycon that Rusa hadn't practiced this contingency procedure very often, but it would have to work. Every now and then, as he pressed on, Rusa got word of his crewmates on the surface and their own efforts on behalf of the geologists. He felt no envy. They had their mission, and he had his. He wondered if they were having an easier time than he was. 4. The climb. Pieces of the moon, chunks, chips, slices, grains, had been in the hands of lunar scientists for 18 months, slowly giving up their secrets. Prior to Apollo 11, one researcher had stated, with possible exaggeration, that if so much as a single gram of lunar material were brought to Earth, the scientific understanding of the moon would increase 1 million-fold. 2 lunar landings later, 122 pounds of rock and dust were inside the sample vault at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory and in laboratories around the world, where the scientists were like children in an unending Christmas morning. Before the first lunar samples arrived, scientists were divided into 2 main camps in their predictions about the moon. Nobel laureate chemist Harold Urey believed the moon was a chunk of debris left over from the formation of the solar system. He subscribed to the impact origin of the moon's craters, looking up at the dark Maria. He envisioned collisions so violent that they created pools of molten rock which froze into smooth plains. Aside from the occasional new crater, Urey believed, the moon had remained cold and unchanged for 4.5 billion years, a primordial fossil. Urey and his followers were known as cold mooners. Other scientists, the hot mooners, believed that all lunar features, from craters to mountains to maria, had been formed by volcanic activity. Some even claimed to have spotted the glow of escaping volcanic gases through their telescopes. Both camps defended their positions with an almost religious fervor. By the time of the first lunar landing, most geologists had taken positions somewhere between the two, envisioning a moon whose surface had been shaped both by impacts and volcanism. They had used telescopic observations and unmanned probe images to construct geologic maps of the moon and work out a rough sequence of lunar geologic history. But neither the geologists nor their astronomer colleagues had reached a consensus. On the most fundamental unknown, the moon's origin, three main theories vied for support. The fission theory stated that the moon had been torn from the infant Earth. The capture theory held that it had formed in another part of the solar system and had later wandered into the Earth's gravitational clutches. The co-accretion theory maintained that the Earth and moon had coalesced separately out of the same cloud of gas and dust. But until the samples arrived, these ideas, and almost any reasoned speculation about the moon, were up for grabs. On the eve of Apollo 11, even a theorist who maintained that the Maria had once been real seas, full of water, not lava, made his voice heard. But the rocks from Tranquility Base said otherwise. In the instant when a handful of geologists inside the lunar receiving lab beheld a gray slab and recognized it as the volcanic rock called basalt, the cold mooners, whether or not they could yet admit it, had lost. The Sea of Tranquility was a plain of congealed lava, and that meant the moon had once been geologically alive. Remarkably, lunar basalts resembled the Earth's in most respects. Under the microscope, their crystals of feldspar, pyroxene, and other familiar minerals looked just like their terrestrial counterparts, but there were some important differences. For one thing, they were pristine. Unlike Earth rocks, they had never been subjected to wind or rain. In fact, not a trace of water showed up in the lunar samples, not even within their molecular structure, nor was any organic material discovered. The geochemists' probings revealed other discrepancies. Lunar basalt contained more titanium than Earth's, but less sodium and other volatile elements, a finding that raised immediate difficulties for advocates of the fission theory. The riddle of the moon's origin wasn't going to be solved after a single lunar landing. But there was basalt on the moon, and the importance of that discovery could not be overstated. On Earth, basalts are formed by partial melting within the layer called the mantle, whose rocks are rich in iron and magnesium. By inference, the moon was not a primitive body, but at some point had become hot enough for its interior to melt and separate into layers of differing composition, including a crust, a mantle, like Earth's, and perhaps an iron-rich core. More than just a relic from the early solar system, the moon was a world with its own evolutionary story to tell, if the scientists could be clever enough to decipher it. They took a giant step when geochemists assayed radioactive isotopes in the Apollo 11 rocks and found that the samples were 3.65 billion years old. That age, which dated the epoch when the Tranquility lavas erupted, was the first hard nail of truth on which the geologists could hang their timeline of lunar history. Contrary to what Harold Urey believed, the Maria were not primordial. Geochemists had already established from meteorites that the birth of the Earth and Moon had happened 4.6 billion years ago, nearly a full eon before the Tranquility lavas poured forth. But some hot mooners had to face the surprising truth that the Moon's volcanic activity took place far earlier than they had thought. The geologists had barely had time to probe the Apollo 11 rocks when Apollo 12's haul arrived. The Mare basalts from the Ocean of Storms were a good 400 million years younger than those from Tranquility Base, confirming the geologists' belief that the Maria did not all form at the same time. That was consistent with geologists' theories about an era of Mare volcanism that may have spanned a few billion years. The Apollo 12 samples also differed in composition from the Apollo 11 rocks and from one another. That implied that the source of the Mare basalts, the lunar mantle, must also vary in composition from one part of the moon to another. Meanwhile, the dust of the moon was telling its own story. It bore the tracks of cosmic rays and was laden with subatomic particles from the sun for the astronomers and solar physicists to study. For the geologists, it sparkled with tiny beads of glass. Some of these, the geologists deduced, had formed by volcanic eruptions, possibly from deep within the moon. Others had likely sprayed out as molten droplets from the tremendous heat of meteorite impacts. In all, the lunar samples from these two landings would have been enough to keep scientists busy for years. But they were not enough. A glance at the full moon reveals that the Maria are surrounded by bright-colored highlands, otherwise known as the Terai, whose composition was still almost totally unknown. The relatively smooth Maria had been the safest choice for the first landings, but after the success of Apollo 12's pinpoint landing, NASA was ready to send astronauts to the more difficult terrain of the lunar highlands. There, at a place called Fra Mauro, Shepard and Mitchell were ending an uneasy night in the lunar module Antares. Friday, February 5th, 8:02 p.m., Houston time, 5 days, 5 hours, 39 minutes, mission elapsed time.
"Are you awake?"
whispered Shepard. In the bottom hammock, Mitchell answered in a hushed voice,
"Hell yes, I'm awake."
"Did you hear that?"
"Hell yes, I heard that."
An unfamiliar sound had jolted the man out of a fitful slumber. It had been hard enough to fall asleep wearing spacesuits, but they were even more uncomfortable because Shepard had put Antares down with one footpad in a small crater, and the whole craft was tilted noticeably to one side. Now, as they lay in the darkened cabin, the strange noise made them wonder whether the lander was resting on solid ground. Shepard whispered,
"You don't suppose this damn thing is tipping over?"
After a momentary realization, why were they whispering? The two men scrambled out of their hammocks, Shepard practically falling onto Mitchell in the process, and raised the window shades and realized that Antares was still firmly perched on the rolling hills of Fra Mauro. For a few more hours they tried to sleep, without success. It didn't matter. They were so anxious to begin the second moonwalk that they felt no exhaustion. Just past 2 a.m. on Saturday, February 6th, Shepard and Mitchell emerged from Antares. Ahead lay the climb up Cone Crater and a search for geologic treasure. They prepared for the traverse by loading supplies onto a two-wheeled cart called the MET, for Modular Equipment Transporter, which carried geology tools, sample bags, magazines of film, and other gear. It also carried a message from Gene Cernan and the backup crew. Before the flight, Cernan's crew had devised a mocking version of the Apollo 14 mission patch featuring the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote cartoon characters. On it, the Coyote, representing Shepard's crew, reaches the moon only to find the Roadrunner. Cernan's crew is already there, waving a first-team banner. Along the border was printed the Roadrunner's trademark, beep beep. The real message was unfit for publication. "Watch your ass, we're right behind you." During the flight, Shepard's crew discovered Roadrunner patches in every notebook and storage locker in their two spacecraft. Even on the lunar surface, they couldn't escape. There, on the Met, was another beep beep. At 2:51 a.m., the men left Antares and headed to the east, where Cone Crater rose into the glare of the morning sun. While Shepard pulled the Met, Mitchell studied a photo map. Their route would take them past a number of large craters, then onto Cone's flank. Reaching the upper slopes, they would head northeast along a broad ridge, following it right to the crater's edge. But almost immediately, he and Shepard had trouble spotting the craters they used as checkpoints. The place was a sea of hummocks, like sand dunes, with depressions in between. Some of them were 10 or 15 feet deep. Under the brilliant sun and black sky, it was like an alien rock-strewn Sahara, and just as difficult to navigate. He found himself looking at the map, thinking, that next crater ought to be 100 meters away, but it was nowhere in sight. Even a large crater could be so well hidden from his view that he wouldn't spot it until he was right next to it. With some care, he and Shepard managed to locate their first sampling stop, where they collected a handful of rocks, snapped photographs, and took readings with a portable magnetometer. After more walking and deliberating, they found their second stop. They lingered there just 5 minutes, long enough for Shepard to pick up a single rock as a grab sample. Then, as Mitchell took his turn pulling the Met, he gave the rallying cry, "To the top of Cone Crater!" In Houston, Mitchell's words were heard by Capcom Fred Hayes, who had once planned to make this climb with Jim Lovell. Now he served as Shepard and Mitchell's link with Mission Control and with a back room full of eager geologists. As he listened, Hayes followed along on his own photo map. He could also check the man's position by glancing at one of the big screens at the front of the control room. On the board, Hayes saw that the man should be near the sloping side of Cone Crater. Then came Mitchell's voice. "We're starting uphill." The ground on Cone's flank was firmer, but there were more rocks, and Mitchell was forced to slow down as he threaded a winding course among the craters. Every time the Met's wheels hit a rock, it lurched upward in slow motion, and he worried it would tip over and scatter equipment and samples across the landscape. Shepard finally grabbed the back of the cart, and the two men carried it, while Shepard jokingly muttered, left, right, like a foot soldier. From Earth, Hayes radioed, "There were two guys sitting next to me who kind of figured you'd end up carrying it up." He didn't have to explain what he meant. Gene Cernan and his lunar module pilot, Joe Engel, had bet Shepard and Mitchell a case of scotch that they wouldn't make it to the top of Cone as long as they had to drag the Met with them. But they were determined. The view into the 1,100-foot-wide pit would be spectacular. Furthermore, the scientists had told them, the deepest rocks blasted out of Cone would lie at the rim itself. With or without the Met, they would get there. Anything less, in Mitchell's mind, would be less than a full-up mission. Just ahead, the ground sloped upward in what was surely the last rise before the summit. But the climb was far more tiring than they expected. The stiffness of their pressurized suits fought every step. As Shepard and Mitchell took a much-needed rest, they stole a moment to look behind them at the bright, undulating plains of Frau Mauro. Tracks from the Met's two small rubber tires stretched like shiny ribbons down the hillside into the broad valley where Antares rested like a tiny-scale model. Already the men were more than twice as far from their LM as any previous moonwalkers. Like their predecessors, Shepard and Mitchell found that the lack of familiar landmarks and the unreal clarity of the scene made it almost impossible to judge distances, and that only made navigating more difficult. But the climb was almost over now. From this high place, Shepard and Mitchell savored the anticipation of victory. One thing puzzled Mitchell. If they were nearly at the rim of the crater, it didn't look anything like he expected. On one of the field trips with the geologists, they'd visited a nuclear explosion crater in Nevada, and that thing had boulders the size of small cars around its rim. But there were no such rocks here. Seconds later, as he and Shepard reached the top of the rise, he knew why. "We haven't reached the rim yet," Shepard said, his voice betraying little of his surprise. All they had done was climb over a ridge. Out ahead, Cone's flank rose into the distance. Suddenly Mitchell wasn't at all sure where they were. He told Hayes, "Our positions are all in doubt." 4:09 a.m. Down the hall from Mission Control in the Science Operations Room, a 39-year-old geologist named Gordon Swan listened to the transmissions from Frau Mauro. Since the early 1960s, Swan had brought his considerable energy and geologic expertise to the work of planning lunar exploration for the U.S. Geological Survey. Raised in western Colorado, Swan had the humor, sensitivity, and political savvy to be an ideal leader of the Apollo 14 field geology investigation. Swan had helped devise the traverse Shepard and Mitchell were now struggling to complete. Over the years, he had gotten to know most of the astronauts on geology trips and had made some good friends, but he never managed to get close to Shepard and Mitchell. Before the flight, Shepard had told him, "I guess you realize rocks and geology aren't too big with me, but I'll try and do a good job for you." "I can understand that," Swan had answered. "I'm not too big on aeronautical engineering," Shepard replied. "I guess we understand each other." Now that he was on the moon, Shepard seemed to be confirming his promise. He was making his own geological observations. A little earlier, he'd even corrected Mitchell's description of a glass-splattered rock. Swan wasn't surprised, though, that he and Mitchell were having trouble navigating. He knew well from Conrad and Bean's experience that it was one thing to see a feature on an orbital photo and another to recognize it standing on the moon, with no obvious topographic clues. The solution was training. Swan had offered to brief Shepard and Mitchell on how to spot landmarks, and they had invited him to the Cape a few weeks before launch. But when Swan met with them in the crew quarters, they seemed unconcerned. "We'll have the maps," they told him, "and you guys will be in the back room telling us where to go." Swan did his best to get his message across, but the truth was that he and the other geologists couldn't do as well at navigating from a quarter million miles away as the men who were on the moon, and now no one in the back room knew exactly where Shepard and Mitchell were. In his headset, Swan could hear the sound of heavy breathing. The climb was taking its toll. A few minutes ago, Shepard's heart rate had hit 150, prompting a flight surgeon in mission control to request that they stop for a rest. One of the doctors called back to the science support room and asked, "How important is it to get to the top of Cone Crater?" The question was fielded to Swan, but he didn't want to answer. Cone Crater was a natural excavation into the Fra Mauro, and the closer Shepard and Mitchell got to the rim, the deeper the source of the rocks they would pick up. The deepest rocks, and perhaps the most important, would lie near the crater's edge. Getting to the rim was desirable, but not paramount. But Swan didn't want to say that. If he downplayed the rim, he feared, the doctors would call Shepard and Mitchell back. If he recommended to keep going, he knew the managers in the back row of mission control might veto the request. Swan hoped the men would push on as long as they could, and as long as mission control would let them. So he filibustered. Even as he spoke, Swan listened to the voices from the moon. Shepard was arguing to spend more time on collecting samples. He had spotted some boulders up ahead, which he felt sure were deep ejecta from the crater. He wanted to sample them and then turn back. Swan could hear that Mitchell wasn't happy about that idea. "Oh, let's give it a whirl. We can't stop without looking into Cone Crater," he told Shepard. "We've lost everything if we don't get there." Swan could understand the younger man's frustration. No one had ever visited a 370-yard lunar crater, and after coming all this way, it was only natural that Mitchell wanted to look into it. But Swan doubted he would see anything of scientific importance. The unmanned orbiter photos had shown no signs of exposed layers or other features. Just then, Fred Hayes called back to ask for a verdict, and everyone in the room agreed that Shepard and Mitchell had come close enough. Swan heard Hayes' radio. "The word from the back room is they'd like you to consider where you are, the edge of Cone Crater." Mitchell answered, "Think you're finks." But Hayes responded with a bit of leeway. If they thought they could reach the rim soon, it was their decision. Mitchell wasn't giving up. And Mission Control was extending the moonwalk by half an hour. Swan smiled when he heard Shepard say, "We'll press on a little farther, Houston, and keep your eye on the time." 4:17 a.m. Shepard and Mitchell came to another rise and stopped to rest again. All around them, the ground was littered with rocks that must have rained out of the sky like artillery fire after the impact that formed Cone Crater. 230 feet below, the valley was awash in sunlight. Mitchell was sure that somewhere close by, among the rocks, was the crater. "Deke says he'll cover the bed if you'll drop the mat," Hayes said, but Mitchell rejected that idea. They would need their tools when they reached the rim. "The mat's not slowing us down," he said gamely. "It's just a question of time. We'll get there." Following his commander, Mitchell watched him pull the tool cart. He realized Shepard wasn't heading in the right direction. "Al, head left. It's right up there."
"Yeah, I'm going there."
They pushed onward, dodging boulders. Both men were breathing hard. Again they stopped. "We're right in the middle of the boulder field on the west rim," Shepard radioed. "We haven't quite reached the rim yet." When Mitchell heard those words, he realized Shepard thought they were farther to the north than they really were. No wonder he'd been heading toward the rise straight ahead. He thought they were just west of the crater. Mitchell was sure they were south of it. He pulled the map from its holder on the Met. Yes, he could see where they were now. If they headed north, off to the left, they'd reach the rim. He went over to Shepard and showed him the map. "Look," he said, his words interrupted by heavy breathing. "Let me show you something. We're down here. We've got to go there." Mitchell pulled. The Met caught a boulder and almost tipped over, but he saved it. Now the grade flattened out. They had reached the point of maximum elevation, but a minute and a half later the rim was still nowhere in sight. Mitchell realized that once more the moon had fooled them. Intently he studied the map. "This big boulder, Al, that stands out bigger than anything else, we ought to be able to see it." They were so close. If only they had a little more time. But that was something they had just run out of. "Okay, Ed and Al," Hayes's voice was matter-of-fact, but his words meant the quest was over. They'd eaten into the half-hour extension. They couldn't take any more time looking. They had to start sampling. Shepard and Mitchell gathered some rocks from the place where they had stopped, and then they headed down the slope to the northwest toward the strange white rocks Shepard had noticed earlier. The geologists had said the rocks of the lunar highlands would be different, and they surely were, unlike any of the samples they'd seen in the LRL. Wielding a geology hammer, Mitchell approached the boulders, which were 4 or 5 feet high. Streaks of gray and brilliant white ran through them like pulled taffy. At the first strike, an outer surface crumbled away. Mitchell hit the rock again, harder, and knocked off a chip about the size of an egg. Clumsy in his gloves, he struggled to place it in a small Teflon sample bag, rolled up the top, and placed it in the rock bag on the Met. Already it was time to leave. On the way down, Shepard and Mitchell made up for some of the time lost in the climb. Now they could really fly, bounding downhill in giant slow-motion leaps, sailing over rocks as they went. They had no trouble navigating. Fortunately, their last station stop had been near a large boulder. They spotted the big rock while they were still up on the slope and kept it in sight all the way down. 3 hours after they had left Antares, Shepard and Mitchell returned with their precious cargo of rocks and film. By now they were both very tired, but Shepard had something to take care of before the moonwalk ended, a little gotcha for the TV audience. He'd dreamed it up one day during training, when Bob Hope came for a tour of the Space Center. Shepard and Deke Slayton were escorting Hope, and they took him over to the 1/6 G rig they used to simulate walking on the moon. Hope carried a golf club with him everywhere he went, as if it were a pacifier, and he refused to let go of it even when they had him on the rig. There he was, bouncing around with that golf club in his hand, and that's when Shepard, also an avid golfer, said to himself, "There has to be a way." Now Shepard stood before the TV camera. "In my left hand," Shepard announced, "I have a little white pellet that's familiar to millions of Americans." In his right hand, he held the handle from the contingency sample collector, now slightly modified. It had a genuine 6-iron at the end of it. His pressurized suit was so stiff that he had to swing his makeshift club one-handed. His first swing missed, and on the second he shanked the ball. Dropping another ball to the dust, he swung once more and made contact, and as the ball sailed away into the black sky, arcing over the craters in slow motion, Shepard announced, "Miles and miles and miles!" Saturday, February 6th, 7:53 p.m. Houston time, 6 days, 4 hours, 50 minutes, mission elapsed time. The cratered sphere filled the window, hanging in blackness. Kitty Hawk was climbing away from the moon on the great elevator ride. Ed Mitchell felt a weariness that was not just physical exhaustion, but a longing so profound as to be felt in the body. He did not want this moment to end. It wasn't merely the view that was so powerful, it was the idea. He and Shepard had just been down there. They had walked on another planet. Mitchell took a long last look. He knew he would never return. By the next day, the three men were still recovering from the grueling day before. Now the quiet time of the mission had arrived. 3 days with little to do but keep the spacecraft operating and catch up on sleep. The pressure was off. Later, Mitchell would look back and realize he was in the ideal condition for what was about to happen to him. Beyond the command module's windows, a cloud-covered crescent Earth cast its light in the blackness. By now it was a familiar sight, but every once in a while Mitchell stopped to look at it. Gradually, as he worked and glanced at the bright crescent, he was filled with a quiet euphoria, great tranquility, and an overpowering sense of understanding. It was as if he had suddenly begun to hear a new language, one being spoken by the universe itself. No longer did the Earth or anything in the universe seem to be random. There was a sense of order, of worlds and stars and galaxies moving in harmony. In one moment, he was a detached observer, and the next he could see that he was definitely a part of it all. As he worked within the command module, he had a sense of being outside himself, as if someone else's hands, way down there, were turning knobs, flipping switches. He found himself glancing over at Shepard and Rusa, looking for some glimmer in their eyes, some sign that they were sharing any part of this awakening. But they seemed the same as they had always been. He said nothing. Several times during the trip home, the feeling returned, triggered each time by the sight of his home planet. Mitchell knew he had been enlightened, but in a way he did not understand, and with an impact that even now he did not fully sense. In time, it would overshadow even walking on the moon. In it, Mitchell would try to find the seeds of resolution he had longed for all his life. He did not guess, as Kitty Hawk coasted toward Earth, that Stu Rusa and even Al Shepard had tasted their own moments of personal discovery, in ways they would never talk about, at least not to each other. This 360-degree crew had that in common. When Shepard's crew arrived at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory to wait out the rest of their quarantine, they brought along a haul of rocks and photographs that made the geologists ecstatic, but their enthusiasm was tempered by the fact that Shepard and Mitchell hadn't documented their finds as well as the scientists had expected. On the moon, Mitchell radioed the geologists that one of the rocks he collected would be easy to recognize because it had a definite shape. But as one geologist told a reporter, all rocks have a definite shape, and in the LRL, Mitchell could not identify this one among the other samples. And although he and Shepard had trained to photograph rocks in place before collecting them, they had only documented a few samples in this manner. In the weeks to come, the scientists would have to try to locate the rest on the astronauts' panoramic photos. Meanwhile, using standard triangulation methods, some of the scientists had analyzed the pictures from Shepard and Mitchell's climb up Cone Crater and had plotted the path of the two men. The results showed that Shepard and Mitchell had come within only 65 feet of the rim. Mitchell was furious when he heard. Ironically, he and Shepard had come the closest after they abandoned the search, when they walked down the slope to the strange white rocks. If they had continued another 20 yards to the northwest, they would have been staring into the enormous pit. Shepard and Mitchell had already paid up on the bet with Cernan and Engel, but the geologists did them one better. They sent a case of scotch into quarantine. As far as they were concerned, 65 feet was close enough. Gordon Swan got a laugh from Shepard when he said during a debriefing, "You weren't lost, and you didn't know it." One morning around the same time, Shepard made his own discovery. He was reading the paper at breakfast when he noticed an article, "Astronaut Does ESP Experiment on Moon Flight." Shepard laughed. "Hey, Ed," he called out, "did you see this? This is the funniest goddamn thing I ever saw." Mitchell came over to the breakfast table and looked at the article. "I did it, boss," he said. Shepard stared back at him in silence. He could barely believe Mitchell had managed to get away with such a stunt without him finding out about it. If he'd known about it before the flight, he would have hit the ceiling. "Not on this mission, you're not." But right now he was feeling pretty damn good. He'd had his full-up mission. He could afford to be magnanimous. Why let a little thing like this spoil a good breakfast? Not long after he got out of quarantine, Stu Rusa went to Downey to thank the workers at North American who had built the Apollo 14 command module, in a comment that rightfully belonged not only to the astronauts but to Mission Control. One manager told Rusa, "You saved the space program." But within the scientific community, that news was greeted with skepticism. Ever since the first lunar landing, NASA had been criticized for failing to include scientists on Apollo missions. On the day Apollo 14 arrived in lunar orbit, a leading figure in lunar science, Caltech geologist Eugene Shoemaker, was in London to provide televised commentary on the mission for the BBC. At a press conference with an embittered Gordon Cooper, Shoemaker blasted NASA for doing a completely miserable job in integrating scientific goals into the moon program. To Shoemaker, who had always believed that the purpose of sending humans into space was to make discoveries, the potential of this $24 billion undertaking was being wasted. NASA was well aware of the criticisms voiced by Shoemaker and other scientists. Only 3 more lunar landings remained, but they had been planned to answer the scientists' frustrations. With those missions, Apollo would figuratively and literally reach its greatest heights.
Book 3 Chapter 9 The Scientist. The words that John Kennedy spoke before Congress in May 1961 said nothing about going to the moon for science. There was nothing about extending the lifetime of a lunar module to 3 days so that astronauts could make 3 moonwalks instead of 2, or upgrading the backpacks to nearly double the length of each trip outside. Certainly there was nothing that even hinted at developing a battery-powered car that could be folded up in the side of the lunar module like a toy in a matchbox and then, once unloaded on the lunar surface, take the astronauts miles into the distance until their lander was only a speck in the wilderness. And yet, before Apollo was finished, all of this would happen, and it would happen in the name of scientific exploration. Even now, with forces already at work to bring an end to the moon program, Apollo was about to hit its stride. With these new innovations, astronauts would progress from visiting the moon to living there, and the final teams of moon voyagers, with trained eyes and hands, would visit some of the most spectacular places on the moon for the first extended scientific expeditions to another world. For one man in particular, NASA's plans for the last Apollo missions were crucial. His name was Harrison Hagen Schmidt, known to friends as Jack. Dark-eyed and dark-haired, he was given to strong opinions and awful puns. He was also the first geologist astronaut, and his ambition was to be the first scientist to practice his profession on another world. Schmidt hadn't planned to be either a geologist or an astronaut. As a teenager in Silver City, New Mexico, he spent his weekends and summers assisting his father, a respected mining geologist, in the field. When he entered Caltech in the fall of 1953, it was not to study geology, but, like most Caltech undergrads, in hopes of becoming the great physicist of his generation. After half a semester as a physics major, however, he knew it would be otherwise. The next year, Schmidt moved to the more familiar ground of his father's profession. When John Kennedy launched the Apollo program, Schmidt was a graduate student at Harvard, where his nickname was Bullschmidt. The joke among the grad students was that, of course, the first man on the moon ought to be a geologist, but Schmidt showed only a casual interest in the new space program. In the spring of 1964, Schmidt was completing a postdoctoral fellowship, but the job prospects, both in his specialty of economic geology, which includes the study of ore deposits, and in academia, were dim. But some of Schmidt's friends from Caltech and Harvard had gone on to work for Eugene Shoemaker, who had established the U.S. Geological Survey's new astrogeology branch in Flagstaff, Arizona. Their reports encouraged Schmidt, and he wrote to Shoemaker, hoping there might be an opening for him. Gene Shoemaker was one of the brilliant scientists of his generation. He'd made his mark at a young age with the study of Meteor Crater, the 4,000-foot-wide hole in the Arizona desert that is one of the freshest and most recent impact craters on Earth. Shoemaker made the first comprehensive geologic analysis of the crater and, in the process, reconstructed the awesome event that produced it. 50,000 years ago, a 150-foot iron meteorite slammed into the plains and exploded with the force of a 20-megaton nuclear bomb. No wonder the entrepreneurs and scientists who had searched for the remains of the intruder had failed. Most of it had vaporized in an instant, and Meteor Crater was tiny, insignificant compared to the hundreds of lunar craters that can be spotted with no more than a pair of binoculars. The moon's pockmarked face testifies to eons of bombardment by asteroids, leftover debris from the formation of the solar system. Shoemaker knew that the Earth had endured the same terrible onslaught. Anyone who wanted to see what our own planet looked like billions of years ago need only look at the moon. But the Earth's ancient craters, along with most other signs of that era, have long been erased by the relentless forces of geologic activity. The surface is constantly reshaped by mountain building, volcanoes, glaciers, and erosion by wind and water. The moon, which died geologically while the Earth was still young, remains a museum world, When Shoemaker looked at the moon, he saw a 4.6-billion-year history book waiting to be read. By 1964, at age 36, Shoemaker had put together from scratch, nearly single-handedly, a new scientific discipline called lunar geology. At that time, the words lunar geology barely had any meaning to most people, but Shoemaker had made the first detailed geologic map of part of the moon and had established a system for delineating lunar geologic time. Working from telescopic photos, Shoemaker and his USGS colleagues had staked out parcels of moonscape the way survey geologists will tackle the corner of a state, to the survey's map list, brimming with titles like Geologic Map of the Sawtooth Ridge Quadrangle of Montana. They added titles such as Geologic Map of the Copernicus Quadrangle of the Moon. But Shoemaker's ambitions were even more far-reaching than his telescope. In 1948, as a 20-year-old Caltech geology student, he'd read of experiments with captured V-2 rockets and foreseen the coming of space exploration. He also knew that he wanted to be part of it. Since then, he had built his career on being the first scientist on the moon. By 1962, with the moon a national goal, Shoemaker's efforts went into high gear, and if NASA wasn't taking scientists into the astronaut corps, Shoemaker would do what he could to change that. But his dream was abruptly shattered in 1963 when he was diagnosed with Addison's disease. Even then, Shoemaker continued to pressure NASA to take scientists into the astronaut corps. Whoever he turned out to be, Shoemaker knew that the first geologist on the moon, the man who would go where Shoemaker so longed to go, would have an unprecedented chance for scientific discovery. Schmidt's letter crossed in the mail with an invitation from Shoemaker to join the work underway at Flagstaff. Schmidt became part of an effort to figure out techniques for field geology on the moon. He had been at Flagstaff only a few months when, in October 1964, Shoemaker's efforts paid off. NASA announced it would select scientist astronauts. The National Academy of Sciences would screen applicants and submit a list of recommendations to NASA. Shoemaker immediately encouraged Schmidt and two others on his staff to apply. In all, more than 1,000 scientists sent their names to the Academy, far fewer than the selection committee had hoped. It appeared that most of the country's top young scientists weren't willing to gamble their careers on what they saw as a slim chance of going into space. The Academy had hoped to cull 50 or 60 names, from which NASA might select a dozen or so astronauts, but in the end they sent only 16 names to the space agency. Three of Shoemaker's people, including Schmidt, made the list. NASA rejected all three. In fact, none of the geologists recommended by the Academy passed NASA's physical. Shoemaker was astonished. To select scientist astronauts for a moon program and not include a single geologist was beyond his comprehension. Of all the geologists, Schmidt had come the closest to passing, and Shoemaker persevered on his behalf. None other than Randy Lovelace, the country's top aerospace physician, reviewed Schmidt's case and pronounced him fit to fly. When NASA announced the names of six new scientist astronauts in June 1965, Schmidt was on the list. They were outsiders from the moment they arrived. The astronauts knew about the pressure from the National Academy, the lobbying in Washington, the letters and phone calls, and they couldn't believe that Deke would have taken on a bunch of scientists if they hadn't been forced down NASA's throat. Behind their office doors, they wondered what it would accomplish. Nothing personal, but what were a bunch of scientists going to contribute? In the race to the moon, science was excess baggage. However the pilots may have felt about